Hi, it's Helen Hebert. It's December 16th, 2016, and I'm in Edwards, Colorado with Susan MacIndolan. This is Paper Talk. And hi, Susan.
Hi, Helen.
I wanted to ask you how you got started with papermaking. You grew up in a papermaking town, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in central Maine, and the main industry there was a paper mill. So everybody in town pretty much had some connection to that mill. And people knew, you know, how paper was made, what it was made from. Up there, obviously, it was trees. And instead of, you know, going on a geology field trip like you did here, you do in Colorado when you're in third grade, you go to the paper mill for your field trip. And, you know, it's a pretty spectacular kind of place with these gigantic, loud machines and, you know, 100 degrees or whatever. And the other thing was you all had these end rolls in your house that were the, like, 3 foot, 2 to 3 foot ends of the newsprint roll. That came off the machine that, I don't know why they just didn't make them the right size, but there were all these ends, and so you always had this big roll of newsprint in your house that you could use for drawing or whatever, you know.
So what was your family's connection?
My dad was head of the purchasing department, so he was in charge of getting the things to the mill that they needed to make the paper. The things they used in huge amounts that came from somewhere else. Like, I remember he had to go to a mine in Puebla, Mexico. It must have been for some kind of clay or something. Because they made newsprint and they made coated paper for magazines. So they must have had fillers and clay for the coating. Right. And I know they also, there was a bentonite mine in Texas, and he would go there. And I knew he had to go to South America for oil once, and they would, like, have, you know, ships come up and get gigantic amounts of oil. I don't know what they did with it. And they also used hydropower, so. Anyway, Dad worked there. That was his job. My husband, Charles, was a, worked in the mill actually before he got out of high school. And they called it working on the window. And you would go up, you know, it was the best pay around. You would go up and see what jobs they had that day. And you could pick up a shift, you know. And
so it was no experience necessary.
Well, it was on the job training. And the mills ran 24 hours a day.
Wow.
So you could work all these different shifts during the day, and inevitably, you know, you would work overtime and get a lot of extra pay, or on weekends, someone was always in there, and the machines were constantly breaking and constantly needing repairs, so you knew which job would be a good job, and if you didn't want it, you could just say, okay, I'll be back tomorrow, or whatever. But he told me he started when he was, I think, senior in high school, and would work on weekends. And also during college, to put himself through college.
And did the town smell?
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of long-lasting environmental effects. To this day, I think, you know, dioxin is I think it's been called the most toxic chemical ever produced by man. And it was a huge byproduct of the digesting process when they cooked the pulp.
Right.
So I think a lot of people got really sick, you know, not to say nothing about clear-cutting trees to make pulp.
Right.
My dad and I got in a lot of fights about this when I was young. I was very anti paper making, the way they did it.
So how did you discover hand paper making?
I went to kind of a local college, the University of Maine, and they had a huge pulp and paper technology department. And I was in fine arts. And we had a visiting artist come once in the, this would have been the late 70s, and he was going to teach us about cast paper.
Mm-hmm.
So we made molds out of plaster and silicone, which was a coating you put in the molds. And then we went over to the pulp and paper technology department with our 5-gallon buckets, and we had cotton linter.
Mm-hmm.
And we climbed up like a 10-foot ladder and threw the linters over this, it must have been about a 500-pound beater. It was a gigantic circular beater in the middle of this big warehouse type of a you know, classroom or whatever you want to call it. And then there was a tap at the bottom, and that, you know, after you didn't have to beat it very long, these things were incredible. You'd grind up a couch in there in about 2 minutes. You know?
So it could process a very small amount, even though it was a 500-pound beater?
Yeah, I don't know how many pounds it was.
Uh-huh.
I maybe exaggerating. But you had to climb this big ladder, you know, and there was a lot of pulp in there. I cannot remember how many pounds of linters we put in there.
And so who was the instructor?
His name was John Scott.
Uh-huh.
And he was a sculptor from Xavier University.
Uh-huh.
I remember him very well. He was a really interesting artist. And he showed us how to do this cast paper. And we did a bunch of body casts, you know, of faces and hands and... God, I think I still have an old piece in this house.
So you made molds.
We made molds,
and then you
these
cast.
Composite molds, and made these large, you know, mold, large imagery. Oh my gosh! Now that I'm thinking of it, we made different casts of different things, and then we put those casts. We made wax models of those casts, and then put the wax pieces together, and then made a final big mold of this kind of collage type mm-hmm. sculpture thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cast the cotton pulp into that. And I don't remember using any kind of color or anything.
Was that a whole semester that he was there?
It was called a spring intensive,
okay.
And it was like every day for a month, something mm-hmm. like that, in between mm-hmm. semesters.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working, you know, really hard. And it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, and I loved the three-dimensional component of it. And all of a sudden, there was a way to, wow, you know, paper could be art.
Right.
And so that was kind of an aha moment, even though I grew up knowing about paper,
right.
And it wasn't that magical to me.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so what... So then, did you keep doing that in college, or what was the next step in your career?
I remember doing, I was mostly involved in printmaking at that point. I remember making sheets somehow and printing on them. I also remember right after I got out of undergrad, I went to Carriage House for some... weekend workshops, maybe. We would go to Boston quite frequently, and I met Elaine, and she was, I don't know how long.
Elaine Koretsky.
Yeah, Elaine Koretsky, and she was doing workshops right out of the Carriage House.
Mm-hmm.
Before it was just a museum, it
right.
was a working studio. And I learned about color from her, and then I learned about other fibers, and... then decided I wanted to go to grad school for paper
uh-huh.
and prints.
Uh-huh. And so what was that process of, where could you even go? Like, did you hone in on one place, or were there many places that you could even study that?
There weren't that many places back then. Oh, I forgot. I worked at Haystack two summers in a row in Maine. And I believe I met Kathy Clark there. Kathy and Howard were there doing something.
So they had a papermaking
They didn't really have paper
making. Because they do
now.
But.
I think at the time they were bringing one of Howie's beaters there.
Okay.
And they had, it was like a book arts program going on.
Uh-huh.
And I was actually working for a ceramics professor there. I was still an undergrad, and I was there as a ceramics assistant. Because I did ceramics on the side, and I had a business, but I didn't tell any of my professors about that.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a very focused, you know, fine art, ivory tower kind of school at the University of Maine. And there was no craft.
Uh-huh.
But Haystack, you know, was a real eye-opener for that whole aspect of it. But then the next summer when I worked at Haystack, I worked with the man from Alfred, who was there doing book arts.
Mm-hmm.
And the beater was there. So Howie and Catherine must have left that beater there.
Okay.
And we made, I think mostly we made cotton and abaca. And we made sheets. There was no printmaking there then, and I actually helped them set up a small print shop. Mm. And then we made books.
Okay.
And, yeah, and there weren't that many paper places, art departments that had paper studios. Somehow I did find out that the University of Colorado had a paper studio.
And who was running that?
Well, the funny thing was nobody was really running it. I went there for lithography, mostly, and the professor, Clint Klein, sort of let the current grad student take over the paper shop. Ray Tomasa had been there before me.
Mm-hmm.
Peggy Prentice had been there before me. And so I came in after they left. And I remember once Bernie Vinzani came mm-hmm. and gave a workshop. And, you know, that gave me a lot of ideas about how to work with colored pulps and stencils. I remember he taught us how to do that. And this was really archaic compared to, you know, what you can do now with finely beaten pulps and all that. And I can't remember what equipment we had. Was that green beater like you used to have in
Portland? Yeah, Davis Hodges.
Davis Hodges, that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy, Mike Hodges, or somebody, Davis. I think Ray and Peggy had him build one for each of them, and... Then he made 10 or 15 of them, and
okay. They're
all around the country now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only beater I remember having there. And
so what was your focus then in grad school? Is that when you kind of honed in on your style of paper making and printing?
Well, I did a lot of installations.
Uh-huh.
And so I used paper... I used it as a way to make shaped sheets that I could print on.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot of hand paper, you know, that you could buy anywhere
right. Back
then. And I decided I wanted to make shaped pieces. So, you know, you have to go through. And in the old days, they made us make our own molds, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
These really nice mahogany with laid brass, you know.
Wow.
And all this stuff. So that was part of the schooling to do that. And then we cut all of our inner decals out of masonite board.
Uh-huh.
So we were in the wood shop all the time making all this stuff. And then,
so we is how many of you? And was there a papermaking class or you were teaching it?
I hardly even remember,
okay. You
know?
Uh-huh.
There weren't any other grad students making paper, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a class.
Okay.
And I can't remember.
That's okay.
But I made hundreds of shaped sheets of paper. And then mostly I was printing monotype mm-hmm. on them towards the end of school. I started out printing... lithography on papers, and then I got really burned out on editioning lithographs. Mm-hmm. I started doing a lot of monotypes, and the installation I did for my thesis show was a big... it was shape papers, monotypes. There were hundreds of them that filled up a huge, like, 30-foot gallery. And, yeah, that was pretty weird stuff. But as soon as I left Colorado, I went to San Antonio, Texas. I got that job right out of grad school.
At the Southwest Texas Craft Center.
At the time, it was called the Southwest School of Art and Crafts, okay. I think. And Jeffrey Moore had gone down there to be the director. And I knew him because of Anderson Ranch in Colorado. He was the director at Anderson Ranch. And he moved down there to take over. And he wanted to build a paper studio. And there were no paper studios in South Texas. So it was the first one. And there were a lot of logistical hoops to jump through because it was a... What do you call it when a building... It's a historically registered building.
Oh, right.
And we were going to build a studio in this part of the building that was historically registered. So we had to make, you know, get special permits and... You know what it's like building a paper studio from scratch. You've got to have floor drains and pour concrete. And we were actually rehabbing an old space. And that was in 1984.
Okay.
The summer of 1984. And Bernie Vinzani came down. I guess he was finished at Twin Rocker. And he came down and was hired to build a press and a beater and to consult on the design of the paper studio.
Okay. And so what was your role and what happened in that studio once it was built?
Well, it took us all summer. Bernie built this big, like, I don't know, it was like 4 by 4 foot press that is still there and being used, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he left me in charge of, quote, building the beater. Mm-hmm. And he made the box, and I had to do all of this, what do you call that marine spar stuff, you know, that you layer over
fiberglass?
Wood.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't fiberglass, but it was this, you know, polyester resin.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, that was pretty bad. And he had, I think, David Raina make a roll.
Uh-huh.
And then the roll got shipped out, and I had to figure out how to get the thing put together after Bernie left, which was, I was really scared.
Uh-huh.
And you had to grind in the bed plate with carborundum and all that. Yeah. I was like, oh, gosh. And then I was in charge of teaching classes, running a small production stationery business for their then shop at the school that was selling things that were made on site.
Oh, cool.
And the other component was working with visiting artists who would come in and we would produce an edition of paperwork.
Mm-hmm. So, like, who did you work with?
So that's how I met Nance O'Banion.
Uh-huh.
And that is how I ended up making these screens that you see in my studio, because Nance taught me how to do that, and eliminating the press.
Right, so these, let's just describe those. So these are, it's like silk screen stretched over a frame that you can couch directly onto. So you skip having to have felts and pressing because the sheets dry right on there. And you don't do the vacuum on the back, but Nance did that, I think, to suck out extra water.
I think she did, and she made larger pieces that were like modular and overlapped.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my students did that, too, after having Nance there. You know, Mary Ellen Matthews, who was worked in our studio down there, was one of my students. She did a lot of larger pieces the same way Nance did. And you would couch multiple things and overlap the sheets on the big screen. You know, those screens are about like 5 feet by 5 feet, I guess. And Nance used abaca.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much all she used. So at the time, I had not made any Japanese paper. Okay. I didn't know anything about Japanese paper. Which reminds me, while I was in grad school, before I moved to Texas, I worked at Oxbow for 2 summers with Paul Roberts.
Oh, okay.
And one of the summers when we were there, we went up to Tim Barrett's studio.
In Kalamazoo.
In Kalamazoo. He was living in the barn at his parents' farm.
Uh-huh.
I think he had just got back from Japan, and he taught us how to make traditional Japanese sheets.
Uh-huh.
And how to process fiber and all of that. And so that's where I learned how to use kozo. And, of course, it was very traditional the way he did it. The way I do it now, I don't use the traditional technique. It's the modified, processing the fiber and the pulp in the same way, hand beating it, but not using a press. You know, it goes right up on the, right out of the vat, couched directly on the screen. No vacuum or anything like that. Just
but you're
dries.
Using Formation Aid.
I'm using Formation Aid.
And you're using kozo and mixing in plant fibers.
Yeah, I do that. Mostly I use kozo and gampi.
Uh-huh.
Because of that stenciling technique that I use, where I double dip from one color to another, and I use the gampi, you know, because it's so fine, mm-hmm. and you can, it works real well with this stenciling technique with the foam stencils.
So you've switched from the Masonite, which you learned how to make shape sheets, to just that children's craft foam?
Yeah, I just use that thin really craft easily. Foam that you can cut. And it sticks on the screen, on mm-hmm. the mold.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can dip in one color.
And then put a stencil and dip in another.
Well, I usually start with the stencil first, dip in, and then remove the stencil, and then go to another color. And, you know, I can dip in 2 or 3 different vats and layer up the shape and the color and then couch that onto the drying screen.
Right. So are you building up your sheet backwards?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then you print also. You add print sometimes.
Yeah.
Or usually.
Yeah, I make the sheets knowing that what I'm going to print on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, kind of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
With a certain intention in mind. So I know what the colors are I want to use, some of the shape and some of the patterning.
Right.
And then the print is the top graphic element.
Right. And so let's go back to San Antonio. How long were you there?
I was there for about 5 years. Working with a different artist. Right. Oh, yeah, we got off track. So it was Nance O'Banion was one of the first people. Helen Frederick, she uh-huh. came and did a project. Bill Wegman came and we did a big photo project where mm-hmm. we made photo paper, stenciled imagery on cotton rag paper with surface size with gelatin and mm-hmm. then coated with liquid light, which was a silver, photosensitive silver emulsion, and then his photos on the paper. And we did another one of those projects too, Judy Dater. Was another mm-hmm. photographer who came, San Francisco area photographer.
So did you do like one a year, a couple a year?
We did a couple a year,
mm-hmm.
and they were pretty labor intensive, mm-hmm. so I had other assistants who would come in and help. And I think, you know, back then everything was pretty basic what you had. It seems like today there's been a lot of research and upgrading of all these techniques, mm-hmm. and, you know, it was pretty basic and mm-hmm. labor intensive. Not that it isn't today, but
right. And so then, how did you transition from San Antonio back to Colorado? So 5 years you were there.
Yeah, it was about 5 years, and it was one of those marriage compromises.
Uh-huh.
The husband was not a huge fan of South Texas.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So we came back to Colorado, and I did a little traveling right when we came back, you know, teaching. I think I went out to University of Oregon and taught
uh-huh.
at the college there. And I did some visiting artist things. And here it is 30 years later.
Right.
Almost.
Well, you had a kid.
Yeah, had Alex, so then you kind of stay put.
And you built this place with the studio. You put the studio in.
Yeah, and we had a construction business for 25 years here in mm-hmm. Colorado. So my houses I had here always had a studio mm-hmm. connected to them. We mm-hmm. built the studio as part of it. And I taught at the college here for like 10 years. And I did teach some paper making in the summer.
Uh-huh.
But there wasn't, you know, any official studio or anything. We would just work outside or on a patio and outside of the print studio. And
right, and your system doesn't really require any specialized equipment. You're hand beading. You don't have a press. You don't need a beater. So that's cool.
And that was a huge thing.
Yeah.
And I think something that all artists have to deal with
mm-hmm.
when you get out of grad school or you get out of your studio where you're working or teaching. And I had a big, aha moment when I thought to myself, I am not going to be tied to all this equipment. I actually was having some health issues. Now I remember. That was a rough time in my life. And I wanted specifically to not have such a labor-intensive process.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided then and there, I have to make this easier. I have to make it less, you know, technically dependent on huge machinery that requires, you know, major... I don't know what you want to call it, physical labor.
Right.
All papermakers know what it takes to make paper. So I had to transition to real low tech, and it's been 20, 25 years doing that.
Right. Well, it's really smart because, when I go teach somewhere that has all of this equipment, students come and then they're like, how can we do this now?
That's right.
So it's, it's tricky.
It's a tough transition mm-hmm. from students mm-hmm. into the real world. How am I going to keep making this?
And
what do I need? How am I going to get all this money and buy all this equipment and move it to where?
Right.
Yeah.
So, let's wrap up with something you're working on now. You working on any projects?
Well, I'm just getting all the garden material and plant fibers processed and getting ready to go again down to Texas, down mm-hmm. to San Antonio, back to the current Southwest School of Art and work in their paper studio in January and part of February. And luckily, they still have all those big molds,
right.
And I pretty much get to set up and make really big sheets that I can't make in my own studio. They have some big vats that Lee McDonald, I don't know how they ended up there, but they did. Beck Whitehead ended up with these Lee McDonald molds. So
can you physically pull large sheets, or do you set up a pouring system?
No, I pull them.
Uh-huh. What size?
They're not that large, actually. You know,
20 by 30
or something.
Something
like that. 18 by 24, 22 by 30. And yeah, it's tricky. Mm-hmm. But I only do that kind of work like for a few weeks a year.
Right.
So, and the other thing that's cool they have down there is the last time I was there, I made some plates on the CNC router. I've had a lot of different text in my work over the last few years, and so I've been really interested in some digital plate making in the last few years. So I'll make the sheets of paper, and then I'll have some of these digital prints that I'll bring back, the place I make digitally, bring back to my studio in Colorado and print up.
And here. So you're making wood cut using digital.
Yeah, I use big...
And then CNC.
The big sheets of birch plywood, and those will be carved on the machine, and then I'll print them by hand in my print shop, print/paper studio.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's great. Thanks for giving us a snapshot of your papermaking career. We'll sign off now. Bye, Susan.
Bye. Thanks, Helen.